This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. John Coltrane is widely recognized as one of the most influential jazz musicians of all time, and his roots are right here in North Carolina. Coltrane was born in Hamlet in 1926, grew up in High Point, where he started playing the saxophone. A new documentary explores the life and career of John Coltrane. It's called Chasing Train. And joining me now is John Scheinfeld. He is the writer and director of the documentary. Hello, John.
Hi, Frank. Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you. Talk about John Coltrane's upbringing in High Point, North Carolina. What did life look like for the Coltrane family back then?
I would say very lower middle class. His grandfathers, both of them, were ministers. And he grew up in a very religious family. As you mentioned, born in Hamlet, but at a very young age moved to High Point and was there through high school graduation. And it was an interesting situation when he was 12 years old. All the male members of his family passed away from various ailments, and suddenly it was John with the rest of the women in the family, but no female figures. And I think this was a very traumatic event in his life.
No male figures, right?
No male figures.
Yeah,
yes.
And so talk about that, because you point this out in the documentary. This becomes the moment when he really more or less picks up the saxophone and starts to express himself.
Yes, in his grieving at the moment, he was looking around and trying to find something that would give him some comfort at this time, and he found it in music. As I understand it, there was always music around the house, and there was music in church, of course, with two ministers as his grandfathers. And he also listened to the radio a lot, and in those days, radio was the equivalent, I suppose, of YouTube these days, where you could tune in and hear almost anything for free. And he began to be fascinated by some of the jazz musicians that he heard late at night on the radio.
Talk about his career then in music and how he gets from a kind of music as therapy, right, to music as a profession. Well, tell us about that transition.
Well, one of the things, Frank, that we look at in the film is the overall big picture of Coltrane's musical journey. And what I discovered making the film, because I will confess to you, I was not an obsessed Coltrane fan when I began the film. What one sees when one looks at that big picture is he was really a sponge and absorbed musical taste, technique, repertoire, from any number of sources throughout his life. Early stage, as we said, grandfather's church, radio. In Philadelphia, he came across a coterie of young musicians like him who were fascinated by jazz and tried their best to play it. So what you see is he becomes exposed to many different musicians, many different styles of playing. And, you know, some musicians emerge fully formed. Coltrane was not one of them. It was this sponge effect where he absorbed so much here and there, and it really took him until the mid-50s, until I feel he really was in a place where his own unique voice could come out.
But he was still pretty good the whole time. He teams up with Dizzy Gillespie and Miles Davis. He played in both of those bands, right?
Yes. Well, you know, it's interesting. Dizzy saw something in young Coltrane. But we feature the very first recording that Coltrane ever made when he was 19 years old and he was in the Navy. And we talked to Wynton Marsalis about this recording. And Wynton says, you know, it's really hard to even believe it's Coltrane because the playing is so mediocre. And so I think playing with Dizzy, playing with Earl Bostick, playing with a number of the people that he played with, people saw something. They saw some potential, some talent that needed nurturing. But I would argue it was not really until 1954 or 1955, when he finds himself hired by Miles Davis, that he really came into his own and really began to grow and evolve at a much faster rate than he did earlier on in life.
Was this because he had just picked up enough by then, or was there something about his Miles Davis' influence over him that allowed him to really take off?
That's a really good question. I think it was a combination of both, but I would say largely when he joined Miles' band, he was ready. He had paid his dues. He had played with all kinds of groups, big and small. He'd even played honky-tonk bars. So he had incorporated a number of different disciplines and elements into his sound. But Miles was very disciplined, very talented, and arguably the Miles Davis Quintet became the finest jazz group in the world at that particular time. And so to be part of that, I think, again, continued his musical education. And he learned a lot from Miles.
Well, he picked up a lot of styles. He also he improved in his talent, but he also picked up a bad habit along the way, and that got him kicked out of Dizzy's band and eventually out of Miles' band, right?
Yes. Like many young jazz musicians, he came to feel that his talent could be enhanced through the use of hard drugs. There was a culture of hard drug use in the jazz world at that time, and he fell prey to that. And yes, you're right. He and Jimmy Heath were discovered taking drugs in the basement of a theater by Dizzy Gillespie, and he fired them both. It wasn't enough to stop Coltrane from taking the drugs. He continued to take them, and he took them heroin mostly while he was in Miles' band. And really, the turning point in his life, not only professionally but personally, came in 1957 when the drugs were just getting in the way of his playing. And for Miles Davis, that was an impossible situation. And Miles fired him. And we actually opened the picture at that particular time. I like dramatically opening up at a crisis moment for my hero. And he gets fired by Miles, and it's a crisis point. What's he going to do? Is he going to go down the road of addiction that killed geniuses like Charlie Parker? Or is he going to get himself clean and see where that road takes him? And so we leave him at that crossroad and then go back to tell the story of critical events in his life that helped shape the man and helped shape the music.
And spoiler alert, he did clean himself up. He decided not to go down that road, which is a difficult choice to make because when things are all going wrong, that spiral tends to take itself downward and not up. Train went up, and he eventually quits. He goes cold turkey, and you talk to his stepdaughter, Antonio Andrews, in the documentary about that process and about what that was like for the people around him as he was quitting drugs cold turkey. Let's listen.
Only one time did it ever become difficult for me, and that was when he was withdrawing. And I could hear him. I could see Mommy taking him to the bathroom because he was always regurgitating. He was doing the cold turkey. One night it was really, really bad, and I became really afraid. And I remember praying, saying to myself, please, God, don't take my father.
That's Antonia Andrews in the documentary Chasing Train, the stepdaughter of jazz saxophonist and composer John Coltrane, and the subject of a film by my guest John Scheinfeld, the filmmaker of the documentary Chasing Train that airs this Monday night on many PBS stations. Let's talk about this because this is also his quitting addiction, right? Quitting drugs is also the spiritual awakening for John Coltrane. Tell us about that.
Well, to me, this is what makes Coltrane's story so special and so uplifting and so inspiring is he made the right choice. And it's when he got off the drugs that he began to, as many people have said, he began to ascend. He began to get in touch with his genius and really started to accelerate his evolution as a musician, as a composer, as a player. And to me, as I say, it's a very inspiring story, and that's one that I really wanted to tell. And I think it's the cautionary tale that that precept that somehow drugs will make you a better artist, he proves that to be totally wrong. Interesting thing about Antonia, if I may digress just for a moment, is she was about 11, 12, 13 in the years when John was with the Miles Davis Band and went cold turkey. And she had never, ever given an interview about her father before. Took me 4.5 months to persuade her to do it, and she finally did, and she's wonderful in the film because she gives us a very intimate window into who Coltrane was as a man, as a father. And that's what you want to do in a documentary like this. This is not a history lesson. It's not a musical theory class. This is a portrait of an artist. And what I really wanted to accomplish in Chasing Train was to bring him alive for the audience as a three-dimensional human being. And having someone like Antonia who was there and who saw what he went through and saw the transformation that came as a result of him getting clean, all of that was very instrumental in helping us achieve that goal.
And you take us into the mind of Train himself by way of his words, anyway, through interviews, mostly print interviews, where you have words spoken by actor Denzel Washington. So here's a clip of John Coltrane's words, a quote from an article where Denzel Washington embodies that quote. Let's listen.
After my late teens, I questioned a lot of what I'd found in religion, but I never did anything about it. I was too busy doing other things. Recently, I started looking into what people are thinking when I saw there were so many religions and kind of opposed somewhat to the next and so forth. It screwed up my head. I just couldn't believe that one guy could be right, because if he's right, somebody else has got to be wrong.
That's Denzel Washington reading the words of John Coltrane in the documentary Chasing Train. My guest is John Scheinfeld, who is the filmmaker of the documentary Chasing Train. It's going to air on Monday night on PBS. Tell us more about his spirituality and how that brings us to A Love Supreme, which is perhaps many his best regarded composition.
It's after getting clean that he gets back in touch with his spiritual side. He had fallen far from the tree of his grandfather's. But then he starts exploring many different things. It's not any one religion, and I think that's what makes him also very unique. He reads the Bible, he reads the Quran, he reads the Kabbalah, he reads the theories of Albert Einstein. And he's an exceptionally curious person, Coltrane. And all of these things, again, I keep coming back to that metaphor of the sponge, that he just absorbs thoughts and feelings and concepts from the world around him, and somehow it all gets synthesized back through his horn. And I think what you see in the 10 years after he gets clean is a rapidly accelerating musical exploration where he starts off very traditional bebop, then he starts to compose his own material, then he starts to incorporate other sounds, whether it's African rhythms or Indian sounds and instrumentation, eventually taking him to a very avant-garde period in the last years of his life. But I think the undercurrent of all of this is a spiritual journey of seeking why are we here, what is our purpose, what are we meant to do, and how can I best express that through my music. And I think that's what makes him, again, very different from other musicians who might be in it for the women or the money or the fame. I don't think he cared much about any of that. In fact, you look at his musical output, and he's following his own muse, his own inspiration, rather than playing what was popular at the time.
You said at the beginning of this interview that you really had not come to this project as a huge Coltrane fan. You knew his music and respected it. After having done it, what's your sense of who this man was, and what's your sort of biggest surprise and takeaway after doing all the research?
That's a really good question. I'll answer that two ways. First way is one of the things I learned about him is John Coltrane was many things. Humorous does not seem to have been one of them. I asked everybody that knew him, tell me something funny that Coltrane did or said, and they really couldn't think of anything. And I think that also speaks to who he was, very serious, thoughtful guy, not necessarily a cut-up or anything like that. So anyway, that's one of the things I learned. I think the primary lesson here is he followed his dream. He followed his instincts. He went where he was driven to go, not where he thought he should go. And I think that's a lesson for all of us in life, that sometimes we make choices that are easy choices, take us to places where people won't be critical of us or where we feel we might have the most success or make the most money. And I think I admire greatly his propensity to just go where he felt the music was taking him, and whatever happened career-wise happened. And I think that's rare and noble.
John Sheinfeld, his new documentary called Chasing Train. It's about jazz great. John Coltrane, it's going to air Monday night on PBS. John, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
You can find out more about the show and the documentary at our website, stateofthings.org. State of Things is produced by Anita Rao, Charlie Sheldon Ormond, Laura Pelliser, and Jennifer Brooklyn. Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.